This is Pop Health Week on Healthcare Now Radio. I'm Greg Masters, your co-host and executive producer. Joining me in our virtual studio is co-founder and principal co-host, Fred Goldstein. Fred also wears the hat of president at Accountable Health, LLC. Pop Health Week is your go-to platform for peer-to-peer conversation with industry leaders, innovators, and ecosystem stakeholders, including payers, providers, patients, vendors, and the regulatory community. We come together to swap the best ideas and strategies in population health management. Connect with us via www.popupstudio.productions or drop me a message on Twitter via @GregMastersMPH, and that's Greg with two G's. You can reach Fred direct via Twitter @FSGoldstein or www.accountablehealthllc.com. On this episode of Pop Health Week, we feature Michelle Bounce, the Chief Operating Officer at the J.P. Farley Corporation, an innovative Ohio-based TPA or third-party administrator. Michelle is an active member of Healthcare Administrators Association, licensed in the state of Ohio in life and health. We discuss the role of TPAs in value-based healthcare and that the traditional focus on cost reduction is not creating the value self-funded employers are seeking from care management vendors. So with no further delay, Fred, the mic is yours.
Thanks so much, Greg and Michelle. Welcome to Pop Health Week.
Thank you.
Pleasure to get you on. We're here at the HCAA conference, which has been fascinating. Why don't we first start with your background?
So I run a TPA. I'm the president of a TPA in Cleveland, Ohio. I've been in the industry for about 18 years now, and looking to own an independent TPA, so I'm purchasing the company right now.
Fantastic. And tell us a little bit about the TPA.
Yeah, so the TPA is one of a few still independent TPAs in the United States, unfortunately, and we administer benefits, mostly medical, dental, vision, for self-funded employers, typically a little over 200 or larger in size employees. And we just try to be creative and different about the way that we're administering benefits. How can we actually be impactful to the patient and the plan? Because it's not all about cost. You have to have some value that's actually serving the human.
Mm-hmm. And location, do you service nationally? Are you regional?
Yeah, we are nationally serving independent employers and small employers and large. And so, yeah.
And a number of covered lives or perhaps groups?
A little over 120,000 covered lives right now. We do a lot of interesting things. So
fantastic. So first off, we're here at this conference. It's the HCAA conference, obviously, self-insured groups. What are your thoughts so far?
I love HCAA. I actually serve on the board of HCAA. It is one of my favorite conferences because it's so educational, and I walk out of here. I was talking to you yesterday a little bit about rabbit holes, but I always leave this conference and have 9 additional rabbit holes or research topics I really want to dig into and learn more about, and this one's no different. It's been amazing.
Yeah, I found the presentations to be really good. They're targeted, you know, on specific areas, and then they go deep.
Yeah.
And they give you meaningful things, so it's great to do that. And as well as I like the fact that it's set up with the vendors are in the same space, and it's really a relationship-building kind of conference, which is fantastic.
Yes.
So you mentioned this idea about, like, to dig in and get into rabbit holes. So you sent me some material, some analysis you've done, how you look at things. Let's start first. One thing I saw on your website was just talking about population health.
Yes.
So how do you as a TPA look at population health?
So I love data. Everybody that knows me knows that I'm a little bit of a geek, and how much information it can give you is super incredible. So one of the things that I find frustrating about TPAs is we have got this such a large amount of historical data and current data on employees, on patients, and we don't utilize it in a way that is impactful. So we really look at the data as flat. And it does not need to be flat data. It's very dynamic when you look at it the right way. And so you start thinking of things like population health, and we traditionally look at that as a risk scoring and controlling chronic conditions and how are we going to manage diabetes and hypertension. But I think it can be so much more. And having a shift left mentality of how far left can we shift? Where can we identify somebody that we don't know is a risk at all, and catch them before they become a chronic condition, before they become catastrophic. And what I'm finding in the data, at least on our book of business, is that we have about a third of our population completely unknown to us from a risk score perspective, that go from no risk or barely any risk to catastrophic overnight. And when you look back at the historical data, there are early indicators that we should be grasping that help us understand when we can intervene and really connect with that person.
So can you give an example of what some of those early indicators might be or cases like this?
Yes. So oftentimes we look at ER utilization, right? Everybody loves to look at the ER reports and was it necessary, was it not necessary? But there are some really interesting things we can take from emergency room data. And some of those things are, how frequently is a person going? Did they have a PCP? Or have they seen a physician in the last year? Did they follow up with a physician after the emergency room visit? And those are all indicators that we may have a problem in the near future. So when somebody is going to the emergency room, and you look at it two or three times in a 24-month period of time, if somebody's gone to the emergency room, they have no PCP, and they have no follow-up with a physician, oftentimes within a couple years, you are going to see that same person go from no chronic conditions because they're not managing anything to catastrophic. And so you can take some of those early indicators and say, wow, maybe I can engage with the patient 2 weeks after their emergency room visit and see if I can help them find a physician to follow up with.
So are you setting up those kinds of programs now or already have them set up?
Yeah, so I've been building triggers in Power BI to help us identify those things. And rabbit holes, of course. Every time you identify one, you can identify 10 more. And so it's what do you work on first and how can you be most impactful? And it gets really exciting. But to see even one or two people that you've managed to change the lives of is absolutely incredible.
That's a really good example. So do you have your own internal care management and care coordination staff, or are you using another company, or how does that work?
So we outsource care management. I'm not, I hate to offend anybody, I'm not a huge fan of traditional care management. And the reason why I'm not a huge fan is I think care management has really morphed into an insurance commodity, meaning that our care managers, our clinicians that could be doing so much good for the patient, have now been put in a position where they can only serve the administration of the plan. And it's sad because the vast majority of our care managers spend most of their time talking to the hospital, doing prior authorizations, and getting clinical data, and they're not really focused on the member. There's very little communication.
Well, it's fascinating. You mentioned that. I should agree with you pretty much. It also, in my mind, has become so formalized in terms of structure. Okay, you have this person, and you can contact them this time. And everybody's different. And so when we did care management, our staff had a lot of flexibility. Although we put people into low, moderate, and high categories, the nurses and the community resource coordinators and the others who work with them, dietitians, et cetera, who we'd work the care management, were able to be flexible and say, boy, I really need to talk to this person a bunch. And this one I can set back a little bit, but I need to go visit them and things like that. And I think that was much more. But now it's like, well, you get one call a quarter, you get this, yes, you get that, and that's it. So are you looking at possibly building a model more like that, or?
So I'm actually building a model with advocates instead of nurses. And some of them are clinicians and some of them aren't. And we've had the luxury of partnering with clinicians, which has been absolutely amazing. So our advocates can get people in touch with a physician or a nurse. But what we found is that, as you said, you have to meet somebody where they need to be met. And everybody has a different methodology, and you'll see like geography and demographics play a big part in this. Should we be texting people? Should we be sending them letters? And also giving them choices. We are an administrator, and so everybody looks at us as insurance. And they often look at case management as an affiliated entity of the insurance. And so there's a mistrust there right off the bat. And we see that often in the fact that people don't respond to care managers. They don't want their insurance involved in their medical decisions. And so one of the things that I have actually found helpful is when we have an early indicator, like so somebody is going to physical therapy for their knee, or they may be getting joint injections, there are often opportunities at that point to send them a letter and look at quality data in their geography and say, here are 10 orthopedic surgeons that may be somebody this person can use, and they're all in network, and here are their scores, their quality scores. We're not telling them, go here, go there, go here. We're simply pulling data on physicians in their area that they may need in the next 12 months and saying, hey, by the way, if you happen to need an orthopedic surgeon, here's some great options for you. And allowing them to make a choice, but an educated choice. And I think that's one of the things that we're doing wrong is we keep pushing cost and shopping to people, but we're not giving them the educational tools that they feel comfortable or trust using to make those decisions.
You mentioned quality data and giving that to them as well with these orthopedic surgeons as an example. How do you get that? How have you developed that data?
So we use Quantros Analytics, and Quantros is tied into Virtual Benefit Administrators, which is our claims platform. And so it's actually, we can see it in our claims data, and then we can see it on physicians that even have not had a claim with us. I don't love the weighting. The weighting of quality and how it's determined whether or not a provider is a quality provider, but it's a whole nother rabbit hole that I think we really have got to dive into and you know resolve some of those issues. But it's a good start, and it gives us a very, very good indicator of which physicians are doing a good job, not having a lot of infection rates or complications or readmissions. And those are good indicators, so we start there.
I like your use of the word advocate and having an advocate for the individuals. What's been the response from your members?
So we typically start with correspondence either through their HR or through the mail or through text or email, and we start with things that will be useful to them. We never ever talk to our members about cost. If somebody came to me and said, wow, Michelle, your husband needs back surgery, we want him to go to the cheapest physician out there, I would have a visceral response to that. It's not a positive thing to talk to somebody about cost. And the people in this industry understand that cost and quality go hand in hand. Typically, the higher quality, the lower the cost. We need to change the conversation and think about human psychology. And so if we engage people at a level that they can connect with, go see the highest quality physicians. Here is some information that may be useful. This is how we build trust with people. And then our advocates get better traction after that. So it's all about giving people the information they want, not that we think we need to shove down their throats. And if you can build trust and help them understand that we'll give them pieces of information or education that isn't readily available on Google that will be helpful to them in the future, then they'll engage at a much higher level with us.
How do you set up your network and do that?
So we use national networks. We also use a bunch of small networks. But I have very much enjoyed direct contracting with different practices. High quality, if we find a high quality orthopedic center or a high quality gastroenterology office, and we can direct contract with them. And the networks are typically agreeable to one way, but not another. And that one way is you can incent people to go to a provider or to a hospital based on the quality of that hospital or provider. Where we cannot incent people is on cost alone. I don't care about cost alone. Let's incent people to go to the best, not the cheapest. And again, the best is often the cheapest, but it's not relevant to the patient.
And as a TPA, have you begun doing any sort of alternate payment methodologies? Are you still paying fee for service? Are you doing any bundles, capitation, things like that?
We do a lot of bundles, specifically on orthopedic. They seem to be the most comfortable with that methodology, and they are accustomed to dealing in things like DRGs or bundled rates for orthopedic surgeries. But a lot of the hospital systems still struggle with that. What I have found is many TPAs will go to a hospital system and say, we want a direct contract with you at RBP or reference-based pricing. Mm-hmm. Well, most hospitals don't understand or don't know how to correlate their charge master back to RBP. They don't know what percentage of Medicare. They're typically being reimbursed at this network or that network. But with the provider MRF files, it is actually really simple to correlate their charge master back to a percentage of Medicare. So you can see on the MRF, Cigna is on average paying 268% of Medicare on the services at this hospital. Let's try to direct contract with them at 250% of Medicare. And you can show them how that is equivalent to what they're getting at a network pricing, not a discount pricing.
And for some of our audience that may not know what MRF is, could you explain that?
They're the machine-readable files, and it is the first step in transparency that we've really taken. And a lot of people in our industry are very focused on the carrier machine-readable files. And I don't find them as useful. They are needed for the member-facing transparency, for the shoppable apps. But what I find is on the hospital machine-readable files, they are so much more detailed in that I can see every network for the same code at that hospital, what those reimbursement rates are. You can see Medicare and Medicaid. And it is so much easier to get a median rate that way and to understand where your negotiating point needs to be and what the hospital needs to be reimbursed to make a profit but not to kill the plan.
For those just joining us, we're in the company of Health Benefits Administration industry veteran Michelle Bounce, Chief Operating Officer at the J.P. Farley Corporation and innovative Ohio-based third-party administrator. We're discussing the role of TPAs in value-based healthcare and that the traditional focus on cost reduction is not creating the value self-funded employers are seeking from care management vendors. Stay tuned for the rest of the story.
You're obviously way into data.
Yes.
I can
yes.
hear it, just listen to you talk. What are your thoughts with some of the newer AI machine learning coming out? Where do you fall on that continuum of great stuff? Oh, I don't know yet.
I love AI in the sense that I think there is a lot that we can do with it. I think there's a lot we can learn from the data. And what I love about it is that we can take large amounts of data and analyze it very quickly and come up with different hypotheses that we can test from that data. What I fear with AI is the same thing we fear in society in general, is you have good people and you have bad people and you have good intentions and bad. And AI makes it a lot easier for people that are bad intentioned to continue and do the wrong thing. One of the places that I keep telling people, please do not use AI, is service. The more we get into the data, the more we really analyze what we can do and what those early indicators are and how we can impact people, the more we're going to need that human connection to help them navigate and understand and trust. And so I think there's a lot of good to be had in it, but I'm also very fearful that we will dehumanize the process even further.
So it sounds like, and this was discussed here as well, the use of chatbots. That's maybe not something you'd be so excited about for the interaction with the member?
I'm not excited at all. Mm-mm. And the reason I say that is because when you think about our industry and why it's so frustrating to people is we've essentially created another language, medical terminology, Latin, Greek, right? Like it's a whole other language. And then our industry has all these acronyms that we use. And then we've asked the average human to get 6 bills from the emergency room and navigate it, figure it out, right? They can't figure this out. And so for me, we've created this convoluted, layered process and made every average human in America purchase it, and we don't help them navigate it. We've completely dehumanized it for them. And I think the use of chatbots and AI for service is just further, it's further creating the problem. It's making the problem so much bigger for people, and it's further dehumanizing the process. And where does the trust come in then? Where, how do we engage people if we're constantly putting them in front of a computer or expecting them to, you know, navigate based on what a chatbot tells you to do?
That's a good point. When you tell people or you talk to people about, say, they're relatively new to this space, they're looking at population health, they're saying, what do I do? Where would you tell them to start?
I've actually had this argument. I wanted a session at HCAA about how sexy this industry is, and everybody laughs at me for this, right? But so we talk about technology, we talk about Google and, you know, all the big tech companies out there and that they're sexy and how do we attract, you know, young people to this industry? There is nothing sexier than the data and the dysfunction in our system to somebody who loves technology or data or digging in or research, right? Learning. There is so much good and so much change that needs to be made. And the rabbit holes are endless. And the fact is, it is pretty much been the same for 40 years. If not the same, we've actually made it worse because we just keep tacking on additional vendors and they have less and less value and they cost more and more money. So the number of rabbit holes you can go down just in digging to the data and understanding those places where you can impact people is incredible. And there is no chance that anybody that is engaged in learning or interested in data would ever get bored. There's so much good to do here. It's incredible.
So just dig in.
Yes, dig in. You will find one thing. It's so funny. I did an analysis. I was looking at ER utilization and how, you know, is there a correlation between how frequently somebody goes to the ER versus what their risk score is? And what I find is if somebody goes to the ER twice in a year versus four times in a year, there is very little difference in their actual risk score. What there is the total cost of that member over a 24-month period of time increases by four times. But their risk score goes up like a half a point. So why is the cost so much higher, but the risk score doesn't? And so then you get into, well, did they have a PCP? There's a rabbit hole. And how does the PCP, you know, impact risk score over a period of time? And predictable risk versus unpredictable risk. There are an endless amount of rabbit holes you can go down. And the beauty of it is everyone has the potential to be impactful. Everyone teaches us human behavior, what we're doing wrong, where and how and when we can be impactful. And it is so rewarding and so much fun, and it's endless.
So you just mentioned the one ER visit, two ER visits.
Yes.
Risk score doesn't go up much,
no.
But cost is a 4X.
Yes.
Excuse me. So, and then you said why?
Yes.
So have you answered it?
Well, rabbit holes, right. To some degree I have, and that is because people who use the emergency room don't actually, most who use the emergency room four times versus two times, don't have a PCP. They're not following up with a physician. They're using it as their physician. And so they're constantly being misdiagnosed or not diagnosed, and so the cost goes up, but there's nothing really wrong. What is wrong is that they haven't found a physician, built a trust relationship, and stabilized where they are, either mentally or physically, because they're going into the emergency room, the ER doctor is making sure they're not dying, and then they're sending them home. Well, that relationship with the physician has to change. And so now you can get into the whole PCP rabbit hole of what's important, and is it chronic condition management, or is it getting ahead of chronic conditions, and how can we get ahead of them? It's a lot of fun.
So have you put in, and that's a great example, and everyone says, man, we got to get these PCPs set up. We know that's the key.
Yeah.
That's the base for everything. Are you now setting up programs to get those people into PCPs, and are you incenting that in any way, or what are you doing there?
Absolutely. So that's incredibly important. We talk about the human psychology of it, and you need to incent them. You certainly need to create plan designs that incent people to go to a PCP. I typically say don't charge them anything to go to a PCP contract. Make it easy. And then understand geographically and demographically what those barriers are for people. So what a lot of people and what a lot of companies don't understand is that a $40 copay or a $20 copay may be enough to incent somebody to go to the emergency room. And why is that? Well, if I go to the emergency room, and I grew up very poor. This is my mother used to take me to the emergency room all the time. That was my doctor's office when I was young. But why did she do that? Because if she took me to an urgent care or she took me to a physician, a PCP, they want money when you show up. And so my mother often didn't have $20 to pay the physician's office or $40 to pay the urgent care. But she knew that if she walked me into the emergency room, they would have to see me, do what they could for me, and send me home, and they could not take money out of her pocket at that time of service. So really thinking about that and thinking about how we can incent people to follow the appropriate pathway and get themselves healthier and have a better avenue for their care than they've had historically is really important.
So when you put these pieces together, and obviously you've got many more, you sent me all this information on you're digging deep into this rabbit hole and that rabbit hole. At the end of the day, will you be able to demonstrate better outcomes and lower costs?
Yes. So that's the incredible thing that we find. So you can easily, by incenting people, and we've seen this over a period of about 4 years now, you can easily show lower cost and better outcomes by simply incenting people to go to higher quality physicians and direct contracting and removing barriers for people to go to the appropriate orthopedic center, the appropriate hospital. But you can also do it with that shift left, that kind of getting ahead of a chronic condition strategy and getting people out of specialist to specialist to specialist or emergency room to urgent care and really getting them engaged with a PCP. And I'm a good example of this. I'm a horrible example for my industry, but a great example for risk scoring and getting healthier over a period of time. So I am historically just, I'm a chicken nugget cheeseburger kind of girl, right? And so I'm just historically very unhealthy, and I live a very high stress, kind of high energy life. And so I hit our large claim report every year for probably 8 years in our company. And it was embarrassing because I renewed the stop loss and I was like, what do I do? But I engaged myself with a concierge physician almost 3 years ago now. And the relationship with her has gotten me so much healthier because not only does she deal with my body, but she deals with my lifestyle and my stress level and how I'm approaching my own self-care. And it has made a big difference in my risk, my health, and my cost over that period of time.
Well, that's fantastic. A personal story. What a great way to end the show. I'd like to thank you so much, Michelle, for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
And back to you, Greg.
And there you have it, folks. That's a wrap on today's broadcast. We want to extend appreciation to our worldwide listeners for tuning in and our deep gratitude to Michelle Bounce, the Chief Operating Officer at the J.P. Farley Corporation and innovative Ohio-based third-party administrator for sharing her insights today. Do keep up with Michelle's work on the web at J.P. Farley via www.jpfarley.com. If you're enjoying our content of Pop Health Week, please show your support. Give us a thumbs up on your favorite podcast platform, share it with your colleagues, and do subscribe to ensure that you don't miss out on future episodes. Remember, we're live on Healthcare Now Radio weekdays at 5:30 a.m., 1:30 p.m., and 9:30 p.m. Eastern. And for our friends in the West Coast, that's 2:30 a.m., 10:30 a.m., and 6:30 p.m. Pacific. From all of us at Pop Health Week, Fred Goldstein, and yours truly, Greg Masters, we urge you to stay safe and stay tuned. Until next time, fare thee well.